outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey.
Boy, did we get a strange gift in the mail.
Oh, yeah?
In the aftermath of Zoe's passing, Sarah gets something in the mail, opened up. It's the softest blanket you would ever imagine.
Okay.
And the whole thing is a picture of Zoe. And on the top of it, it says, if love could have kept you alive, you would have been alive forever. Something like that. Mm. And then underneath it said, Zoe, our guardian angel.
That's a pretty cool gift.
Came without a card, came without an identifier. So I accused a couple people of sending it who wrote back and said, nope, wasn't me. And then we finally the person owned up to it. They wanted to put a card. They weren't trying to be deceptive. They couldn't find a way to put a card in the package. And it didn't come from them. It came from wherever they had it made. Yeah.
Yep.
But man, what a sweet gift as we're still working through Zoe's passing and the void she leaves in our home.
It's still pretty acute, huh?
Mostly, yeah, more for Sarah. Those two had a bond, and this dog got her through the most painful time in her life. So,
yeah,
more for Sarah, I think, than me. And we talk about whether or not we'll get another dog or not, since we've always been a two-dog family. But
yeah,
we haven't figured any of that yet.
Hmm.
So we'll see. And then I guess some people took pretty serious the fact that I made some comment about retiring on here.
Oh,
and people are like, what? You're retiring? You're not going to do anything? I'm going, okay, I'm still doing what I do. That was more tongue in cheek than I think it fully conveyed in the podcast.
Okay. Probably better circle back to that one then.
I would have cleared that up. Anyway, this is a twofer. We did one last week and we're chiming in again same day to do one since I'm going to be gone and we don't have time to get one in before we go. So I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And welcome to the God Journey today. So best thing I heard this week, I've got this I heard a couple of weeks ago, but I love it. And we're talking about the political polarity in the world right now. And it kind of follows well the conversation we had last week about who you get to choose to love or not love if you're on the home team, away team circuit. And my friend from South Africa in a conversation, this is Stefan Vosloo, he said, he's talking about healing and peace in the world. And it starts with a single shared belief. We are all human beings, deserving of dignity and respect. Peace means seeing your enemy as fully human.
Ooh.
Boy, that would change a number of things, wouldn't it?
That would change. I mean, just that, seeing them as fully human would radically change it. I mean, that, because I think so often we dehumanize, we demonize, and that way we can justify some of the tyranny that we inflict on our fellow mankind.
Yeah, it's how we treat people with unlove. You depersonalize them. So they're not just a human being. They're somebody that's done something wrong, somebody that deserves this, doesn't worship the God I worship. They're somehow less than. And I love that. Peace begins when you see your enemy, quote unquote enemy, that's air quotes around it, as fully human and worthy of love. And now you can't treat people the way you may want to treat people for your own convenience. And that's the power of love. What about you?
Well, mine actually came from some homework that I gave you because I wanted to explore a topic with you. And so I sent some homework your way.
Four different articles and things to process. I'm going, I haven't this much homework since I was in college.
Well, you are dealing with a college professor, so I'm sorry.
No, I'm going to look for a new podcast partner next week. So.
Okay. So I sent you a Christianity Today article entitled Moral Failings in the Pulpit Lead to Moral Injury in the Pews.
Ooh.
And it's by Laura Howard, and it goes on to, the subtitle is Church and Pastoral Abuse Can Trigger a Unique Form of PTSD. And so this is a Christianity Today article that I sent you. It really ties into the conversation of moral injury, which is something that I've been exploring a fair amount, both in my own personal research as well as unpacking for students and in a counseling context.
Moral injury is not a term I'd ever heard before you sent this to me. So
really?
I've not heard it. I mean, I've heard of moral and I've heard of injury, but I've never seen them as a term. So for somebody listening going, what's a moral injury? What is it?
Yes. So moral injury came out of mental health research, largely in the military. It was focusing on PTSD research. And what they were finding was, is that there was PTSD experiences where somebody had a horrific experience that occurred. And as a result, they are having, you know, these symptoms, flashbacks, et cetera. But then they found this whole other category of individuals that were not responding to a lot of the traditional trauma care that they've been utilizing in the military. And what they found was in common with these individuals is when these people either witnessed or they themselves violated their own personal moral understanding of what is right and wrong. And so when they violated that, if that was connected to a traumatic experience or a traumatic event, it was significantly more difficult for them to heal from that event because they were also in violation of their sense of well-being or their sense of self, or they observed it and they sat by quietly and did not respond. And so they found that there's a whole other level of healing and internal conflict that occurs when this idea of moral injury, when a person either witnesses or violates their own sense of right and wrong, that is required in order to be able to work through that. Because all of a sudden their internal code of conduct, their sense of right and wrong, their moral compass has been intentionally violated in some form or fashion.
And what can bring that on? What's a good example of that?
Lots of different examples. So in the military context, you would have somebody following an order that they did not believe or violated their own personal belief system. So for example, we're going to go into this village and all of them are combatants. And so anybody that comes out or resists us, they're perceived as a combatant. And so you're going to shoot to kill.
And even 12-year-old kids or
whoever comes out the door, because you never know who's going to be the enemy. And so you're going to assume that they're all a combatant. Or another example would be a medic, and he's got three of his friends that are laying there. He has to pick one of the three to save. And he's a 19-year-old individual who just got out of their military training, medical training. And now he's having to choose one of his three closest friends to decide who's going to live and who's going to die. And he's having to make that choice at 19. So those would be some examples of moral injury in a military context. In a civilian context, it would be examples of extorting someone, working in a corporate setting where you either abused or slandered or embezzled from someone and you either had to go along with it or you yourself just got caught up in it. That would be some of the ideas. Another form of moral injury would be, for example, knowing that a spiritual leader or a leader of a religious organization had been violating their own belief system, their own moral conduct. You found out about it and you were asked to cover it up or you were asked to bury it and you chose to go along with it. Those would be examples of moral injury that are significantly more difficult to heal. And that's this article, as it unpacks it, it really explores that idea of why is religious or spiritual abuse so much more difficult to heal from than other forms of abuse. And a lot of it ties back to this idea of moral injury and the fact that not only is there trauma occurring, but your own sense of right and wrong is also being violated at the same time.
Oh, wow. So it'd be like, you know, something's going on, but people threaten if you say anything and let people in. So now you become a co-conspirator in something that you would consider immoral.
Absolutely.
But you're doing it for some higher good to try and protect the public relations or whatever of the group you're part of, that kind of thing.
Yep, exactly.
Wow. Okay. So best thing you heard this week was part of this?
Yeah, it came out of that. And it was talking about navigating spiritual abuse. And it said, instead of judging our grief, so looking at our grief and holding it in a judgmental state. So instead of judging our grief at experiencing spiritual abuse as a sign of foolish naivete or a source of shame, we should recognize that betrayal hurts and disrupts us in a very profound way.
And then get some help with that, I'm assuming, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Instead of, I think what we tend to do is we tend to keep justifying the thing that we did.
Yeah,
it would be morally wrong in most cases, but in this particular instance, because the pressure was so great and because the potential wrong, we had to really marginalize that person and destroy them.
Yes, yes. And that's, so we...
I've been part of that. I know what that is. I've been part of that.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
Do tell. What do you mean by that?
People who needed to destroy me to justify what they wanted to do, to act in unloving ways, convincing themselves this is a higher form of love.
Yes.
Tough love or whatever.
Oh, absolutely. Or I thought of even the statement that you made a while ago about the individual that you talked to, and they were justifying their affair on their significant other because the first time they had an affair on their significant other had a deep religious spiritual awakening, and so like, oh well, you know, I had another affair on you and it's for your own spiritual well-being. It's like, okay, if that is not a violation of moral, oh my gosh, if that's not a moral injury, I don't know what is.
To both, to the person doing it,
correct,
and to the person who's victimized by it.
Yes.
It was even worse than that. The person said, God told me to have this affair on you.
Oh my gosh.
So that you would be drawn into a deeper place of healing.
Wow.
That's where the justification went. These people are both together still. And the guy who did this has gone on to some really deep healing inside his own heart. So that's ended well.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
But the pain of it and the and feeling genuinely felt like God had told him to. So he'd been in touch with a voice inside his head that wasn't God's voice, but he was convinced it was.
Man, given our conversation last week about who to love, and especially as we were kind of wrapping up about looking at justifying who we love, who do we not love, how do we consider them in our camp, even the ideas of, and this is where I, talking about fear, this is where I really felt like this conversation of moral injury came online, was how many times has it been done to other people where they have justified manipulation, they've justified fear, they've justified the quote-unquote tough love because they're saying, oh, well, you know, this is for your own good. This is because I love you. I'm treating you this way. And it's like, how do you get there? Because that is a direct violation of everything that Jesus lived out in his life. And yet, you are saying that you are a individual that is following Jesus's way, or God told you, Jesus literally told you to violate your own moral and his moral code of conduct to how to live in the world. Oh my gosh. So this article is really intriguing because it unpacks this individual in Christianity Today. They were a part of a church that had been going through some pretty significant disruption in that church, and some upper leadership had been let go because of some different things. And literally the school is like, I don't know if this is a good idea for you to go and do your internship in this church. And their response was, well, actually, I would rather go and work in this community because they are in the middle of challenge. They are in the middle of transition. They are in the middle of chaos versus going and interning at a church that has everything polished and glossed over and ready to go. But man, it was a very interesting exploration of the idea of moral injury, specifically in a spiritual or religious context. But what were your thoughts on it as you read through it? I'm curious.
Well, again, it's something I had not heard of before. So trying to process exactly, and it's conflicting because there's two sides to it. There's the moral unfaithfulness to our own point of view, and then doing something that you have to keep justifying because it didn't work, or because it's at conflict with what you not just some religious rule. It's deeply in conflict with who you are as a person and what you believe in. And then there's the other part of I had a hard time seeing the moral injury of someone who is the victim of that. I mean, I get the injury part. It's incredibly injurious to have somebody make you the target, lie about you to accomplish some end, destroy your reputation as a way to justify their behavior, or at least to mitigate your influence to other people. That's one thing. Mm-hmm. It's another thing to be on the other side of that. I feel like, because one of the lines in here, it made me laugh when I read it. Human beings aren't built for betrayal. I just started laughing. Going, they better be, because that's one of the most incredible attributes about humans who don't understand love, is betrayal is a pretty easy tactic to fall to. Mm. I mean, Jesus suffered it from his own followers. I've had major points of betrayal in my life, and that's why I'm going, okay, maybe others weren't built for it. I think I have been built for it, because
well, that's why I was laughing when I saw that line in there, because I was like, okay, yes, I would say your life though has a more unique and frequent encounter with significant human betrayal than most that I know. And you're still living a healthy life and still have an intact faith. I mean, both of those things are pretty unique to your personal situation.
Except having been through it and being public about those stories, I hear it everywhere I go.
Really?
Interesting. Yeah, betrayal by a business partner.
Yeah.
By, you know, just we got into this thing and then one decided to take control of it at the expense of the others. I've heard it in ministry contexts. So people do a ministry thing together, may write a book, may have a church together, whatever. And then they're going to share it. And then one guy decides he needs to be in charge of it and take all the credit for it. And I hear that story repeatedly. Mm-hmm. I hear it from inside families where lying and manipulating is important to somehow stay part of the family. And your place in the family is determined by your willingness to be controlled by the disgusting elements in the family. So I think I see betrayal as a very common theme in the human experience. Hmm. It's not just mine. I've had four major public betrayals. I have. Yeah. But I've also had minor ones. I've also heard of other people that's willing to just, if it's in my expedience to lie about you, I will lie about you. If it's in my expedient, if it's helpful for me to attack you, to make you feel less than, as for some means of control, or even just the other person jealous of you and wants to feel more spiritual or holy. I see that with Paul in the book of Acts. They go to these synagogues and they would talk about the Messiah and he'd come, and people were just going nuts in the synagogue about it. Then the next week, a whole bunch of other people are coming, outsiders. And they got threatened. And it was like, now we've got to kill Paul. We've got to run him out of the synagogue because we're jealous that that's drawing more of a crowd than what we're doing. So I look at betrayal as a pretty common theme in humanity. And my experience may be jaded on that score.
Well, the intriguing part, so you talked a little bit about the victim and like having a hard time like conceptualizing from the victim's perspective in regards to where's the moral injury in that regard. Where that comes in for the victim is their perception, for example, of love or of healthy authority or of this person's intent in my life is for my good. And then that gets violated and they have a very hard time rectifying that, working through that, understanding that. So one of the big things in trauma counseling is meaning making. So how are you making meaning out of this? How are you understanding that? How are you conceptualizing what happened here? And for people who have experienced moral injury, that have been a victim of moral injury, it's very difficult for them to find meaning in those experiences. So especially like, for example, sexual assault in the military. And so you have somebody who is a military officer and they assault one of the officers or one of the soldiers that's below them. And now all of a sudden, this thing that I joined because I had a sense of honor and code and service and I wanted to give back to my nation, whatever reason why they joined, yeah, and I'm supposed to trust and follow the leaders that are above me. Now, all of a sudden, one of those leaders is my violator, is my abuser, is the perpetrator. And so then it shatters their imagery of why did I even join this thing? What is the morality behind this? And so then they start questioning the thing, and they start questioning themselves, their ability to even check in with themselves. And I think that's one of the really strong things that stands out in this for me is the lack of trust for self. So you, out of these moral injury type situations, you start to distrust your ability to be able to, for example, hear God's voice, or to be able to say, no, this isn't a good situation here, or like, this is, I'm not safe, or this, you know, that yuck meter, trusting that yuck meter, when that's either when you violate it, or when somebody else in leadership that or authority over you that was supposed to be your protector or your leader or your guide, when they violate that, then all of a sudden your code of how to navigate life is completely shattered, and you don't know where to go from there.
Yeah, and it wouldn't just be sexual assault in the military. No. It could be sexual assault in the church office.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
And when you try and talk about it, people are like, no, come on, they would never do that. It's easy to marginalize the victim in settings like that, particularly unless there are multiple victims who are coming forward together, then you might win that. Okay, people are finally going to go with it. But even the church in Dallas, where it was 2005, their leadership is aware of what's happened, and it took till 2024 for it to actually, again, and it was forced from the outside. It wasn't chosen from the inside. And now you've got people, or even like these 2x2 people I've been dealing with, when you realize you've been in this thing, you've been jumping through all these hoops that they've encouraged you to jump through to guarantee your salvation. Then you find that they have not been jumping through the same hoops. They've been violating even worse hoops. And then it's, do I ever trust leadership again? And what they mention in this, particularly in a religious setting, is it gets to people's trust in God. Yes. Do I trust the transcendent anymore?
Correct.
Because I got violated. And I got deeply wounded by someone who is supposed to be a representative of Jesus in my life who didn't prove to be.
And I think it also, that's where family abuse as well is really hard too. Because now all of a sudden, this is the person that was supposed to be your initial experience of unconditional love. This was the person who's supposed to be your protector. This is supposed to be the person that's your guardian, your advocate, your cheerleader. And now they're doing the exact opposite of that. And that is your ability to trust, your ability to gauge things. That was one of the things that it talked about, is then these people move into these spaces where they have a constant questioning of, when's the next shoe going to drop? Is this person, no matter how many times they've proven themselves to be trustworthy, when is that going to fall through? Because I thought this person, because of their title, because of their position, because of their relationship to me, that they were going to be a safe one.
Yeah. And people a lot are talking about how much religious abuse, and it's not necessarily sexual. It can just be the abuse of leadership and control and legalism from the pulpit, and made to feel less than if your yuck meter is going off and everyone else around you is amening and say, yeah, praise God, we're in on this. And yeah. So how do people heal from this moral injury stuff?
So that's, to be honest with you, that's where a lot of my research is actively going on right now, because for me, this is not an area that I've specialized in. I'm fairly new to the conversation of moral injury, because a lot of it goes beyond just the event. It ties into their identity. It ties into their worldview of what's right, wrong. It ties into, you know, even their ability to be able to conceptualize and perceive relationships. And this is a very niche, in some regards, niche form of therapeutic intervention because of how many areas of the life it touches. So I don't feel like I can really respond in a super meaningful way, because it's not something, like, I'm still very much in the research, learning, training phase in regards to what does it look like to even navigate this? Where do you start?
Well, as I read some of what you sent me, and they talked about some steps to healing. And I was looking at those saying, I just personally, when I've been in a place where I guess moral injury could have taken root. Mm-hmm. They talk about some of the symptoms of that is like guilt and shame.
Yep.
Feelings of betrayal. There's feelings of betrayal or this actual betrayal, which yep. is very different. Loss of faith or trust in God and social isolation. And I think that's always what the perpetrators want to put on you. Mm. I look at my experience with these things. And first of all, when they happen and you're caught off guard and you're demoralized inside, my response was, okay, I'm going to get to God. Mm. And I want to find out, is there any truth to what's being said? Is there any truth to this? And I always go down that road, even did with Sarah's letter.
That's literally what came into my mind was that letter. Yeah.
If my whole life has been a lie, Jesus, I want to know it. I want to know it now.
Yeah.
So I don't perpetuate it. So it's always been, I never lost trust in God. I just didn't. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because I didn't see this. There's enough whatever in me that I don't see whether it's my co-pastor or whether it's people who are dishonest in business, what I don't see that as a reflection of God. I just don't. Yeah. So my question, did I deserve this? Mm. And I walk that through with God as best I can. And it talks about getting a community, seek community support. Always when these things happen, I had people I call to sit down and say, okay, this is how I see it.
Yeah.
What's wrong with this? What am I missing? And that conversation's always incredibly helpful. I have the conversation with God about the same thing. Did I deserve this in some way? And not was I imperfect in some way. I'm always imperfect. I was talking to a father today, and he was talking about how he's having a struggle with one of his kids. And he said, I'm not a very good parent, and I don't do this, and I don't do that well. And I'm just going, dude, don't let your kids' difficulties be a comment on you. Because once you go down that road, then you've lost your ability to help them deal with their stuff because it ends up with shame. And he was saying, you know, Christian parents should have better kids than people. I say, whoa, you're shitting on yourself. I'm not going to let you do it. parenting is tough work. It is. Yeah. You will be adjusting to your children till they leave the home. And then when they leave the home, you're like, oh God, please take care of them. Parenting is not easy. Yeah, some kids are incredibly compliant. Some kids are incredibly non-compliant. They're going to have their way no matter what. And finding the way to adjust to that and helping them discover what's going on inside that may be leading to acting out in ways that are painful can be a neat process. But once you turn on yourself, and I read that in some of the moral energy is injury is, okay, I can't trust me. I can't. And one of the scriptures I've lived by in these kinds of moments is Jesus entrusted himself to no man because he knew it was in all men. Mm. And I think we miss that. I know when I was a pastor, we were talking about people getting in home groups and trusting each other. I would never use that language today. Trust is something that is affirmed by how they love you. Trust is not something people get to ask for. I want you to trust me. Only swindlers and politicians and scammers ask you to trust them. Trust is not what you give anybody. What I basically know about people is people, for the most part, people will act in their own expedience, even if that means violating their moral underpinnings, which is what this article is about.
Yeah.
And I've seen it happen over and over again. And you can always tell because when you try and talk about it with them, they can't talk about it.
No.
They don't want to talk about it. They say, hold on a minute. What really happened here? What did I do? And they go, listen, you're too good at talking, so I'm not going to have this conversation with you. Well, hold it a minute. We're not going to learn anything if we don't talk about it.
Yeah.
But I've always been able to say, okay, how they acted was immoral. So I don't sit here and go, okay, so that's a commentary on me. It's not. It's not a commentary on me. And these are people in many cases, many people that I trusted. I got to a place where I think they're pretty well loving people. And I put some investment there that they could hurt me if they wanted to.
Yeah.
And some have chosen to. Most people in my life have not chosen to hurt me. Most have not. Even if it's something's difficult and we've got to work through it, by goodness, let's work through it.
Yeah.
So I look back at this going, I feel like I could probably, and I've been asked to by publishers, could you write a book on betrayal? I really could. I don't know that I will because I'm getting to the point where I'm tired of writing books, but I probably could on betrayal and recovering from it, because I think that's a part of what our life is. And even people from cultic groups, people from abusive marriages. I mean, I go on and on about what betrayal looks like, ghosting looks like, lying about someone for their hurt because you've got to justify your thing. I look at humanity going, okay, that's where most of humanity is. But that's not where I want to live. And so my trust in God never, always these things deepened it. Social isolation, when you're ostracized from a group, and rumors and lies have gone on about that to justify it, I always found other people. I never found myself socially isolated from people to even, I mean, I called 10, 12 people the next day after Sarah was gone. And after some of the stuff with the shack happened, there were people I invited alongside very early on. This is what's going on. Help me. How do I process this? How do I deal with it? And hearing from other people was incredibly helpful as it synced up with what I understood from Jesus, as I could own my stuff and things going, yeah, I should have probably been more careful there, or I could have done that differently, have all been helpful to find my footing again. As you said, find meaning in the pain, find meaning beyond what their intent was, which is you learn something about yourself and you learn something about people and you become wiser in the world. Now, the other kind of abuse, like Sarah's abuse, I don't know how to find meaning in that for her.
Yeah.
That's just way too young, way too cruel. Thing now is, how do I find meaning beyond it? Correct. Maybe then meaning in it.
And that's, so when they talk about trauma resilience, some of the key aspects that they talk about in regards to developing that resilience from a moral injury is the emotional regulation, cognitive flexibility, social support, sense of control, and meaning making. Those are five primary characteristics to develop.
Go over those again and explain them a little bit.
Okay. So emotional regulation. So can you manage your emotions effectively? So are you having those major anger outbursts? Are you having the depressive or the anxiety episodes? Or are you able to be able to regulate those emotions so you can recognize, okay, there's a trigger, or my nerves are a little bit more on edge in this situation. How do I regulate that? How do I stay within my window of tolerance? You know, some of the things that we've talked about in that regard.
Yep.
Cognitive flexibility. So that's being able to look at it through a different lens, or for example, being able to look at it like in the lens of, say, the person that gets assaulted in the military, or the 19-year-old medic that we talked about. It's like, okay, you are 19 years old. You had less than 6 months of medical training. You were put on the battlefield and you saved one of your best friend's lives. Yes, you had to make a choice between those three, but you were trained to save them and you were able to save one of their lives. And that was an incredible feat that you were able to complete. So that would be an example of cognitive flexibility, is not looking through that tiny, as you described it, the knot hole of your pain, but actually being able to widen that perspective and seeing like, okay, there's more going on here than just the really small vantage point that I have of the initial experience.
So reframing it.
Yes. Reframing it. Yep.
Getting a different perspective. Yep.
Absolutely. Yep.
Got it.
And then social support, that's having that really strong social community around you that you can lean into.
Which isn't necessarily 100 people. It can be two or three, four or five really close friends.
And sense of control. So this is an interesting one, because especially like when you're talking about childhood abuse, it's like, well, you couldn't have gained a sense of control or influence over that situation because you were a child. You were being abused in that situation. Yeah. But a lot of the work is, what does it look like for you to start to take back control over your life now? So what does it look like to no longer give in to the addiction? What does it look like to no longer have the victim mentality? What does it look like to you live in a space of internal chaos all the time? What does it look like to take control and to calm that inner space? Those different things of, what does it look like to regain a sense of control over your life now, especially when you were presented with stuff that sometimes you didn't have any control over whatsoever?
Boundaries about not getting myself in a situation that I can be taken advantage of again.
Yes.
The yes. idea of, you know, the old days of forgiveness is you just forgive and forget and you go right back into the abusive situation and do it all over again. Instead, no, boundaries are legitimate ways to say, I'm not going to put myself in the framework of being hurt again. But at the same time, like for me, people said to me, like, I don't know why you would ever do something collaborative again, because you've had two major collaborations that people sidetracked it for their own benefit. And I'll say, yeah, I did. But I've had 50 other collaborations that were fruitfully wonderful. And I think God does things better in teams of people than individuals. So I'm still committed to that. But so the finding the boundaries that are important to maintain a sense of safety, but not so cloistered that you protect yourself from life.
And I think that's where really leaning into that idea of the window of tolerance, right? Because your window of tolerance for collaboration is wider than other people's window of tolerance for collaboration, you know? And so being intentional about, okay, what is within my wheelhouse today? What is within that realm of tolerance for me? God, continue to expand that, continue to heal me, continue to allow that to grow. But I think too, that idea of sense of control really ties back into what we were talking about dwelling and being connected to dwelling with Christ, no matter what our circumstances are. And that's, for me, this is where, especially when we're talking about trauma healing, gosh, that's where faith is so incredibly viable or valuable in that process. Is it's like, I don't know how I could do this without God being a part of it. I don't know how I could do this without the dwelling of the kingdom in my life right now. I don't know. I can't even conceptualize that. And so I think that for me is one of the challenges that people that don't have a deep sense of his love and faith, that makes that healing process that much more difficult.
Yeah. I don't see how people do it either. I look at the things I've been through. If I didn't have God to lean into, if he wasn't present with me, and if he wasn't giving wisdom and comfort in the midst of circumstances that were still unresolved at the time, still causing pain, if he wasn't there with me in it in a tangible way, I don't know how it would have impacted me either. I don't know what it would have done. I would credit that as the number one thing that makes me resilient in times of extremity, is that presence is there. Wisdom is there long enough to hold you until the circumstances change. Yeah. And you can actually go, okay, I can see the amazing things God did through that. Not he did it for that. It's Joseph in Egypt saying, you intended this for evil, but God used it for good. That I can see that a lot in my life.
Yep.
And I think that's, without presence, I don't know how I would get through any of that. So it amazes me that trauma therapy and some of this stuff can work without God, but I don't see how in my life I would have gotten through these things without him.
I agree with you. And that's, you know, tying into the last one, meaning making, and the heart behind that is finding purpose or growth through adversity. It's like, man, if I didn't have the Holy Spirit to help me sort through a lot of that, And some of it, I mean, some of it is just, there isn't a whole lot of meaning to be found other than the fact of, like, for example, when I was navigating the healing with my relationship with my dad, part of it was he's operating off of what he knew. He's operating off of what he was shown. He's operating out of the worldview of some of the incredibly challenging, abusive things that he navigated. Yep. And so, you know, it's like, does that give him a pass? No, but that does give me a more holistic picture of why what happened. And then it also gives an idea of finding purpose and meaning for me moving forward. It's like, okay, this is for me, my dad did the absolute best he could. And he still is, he's still growing. He's still deepening who he is and in our relationship. And he also has provided me with a launching platform to say, okay, now I'm going to go that next degree farther with my girls and hopefully be able to continue to shut down a heritage of trauma, a heritage of abuse, a heritage of anger, bring that to a close in the generation instead of it being able to perpetuate onto another generation.
And there's so much in scripture about adversity being such a tool in God's hand.
Yes.
And such for us not to be surprised when these things happen and not to feel like God has somehow abandoned me because he let people I love abuse me and lie about me or whatever. I grew up with a God that I expected to keep me from these things. Mm-hmm. That was my bias. So when the first one happens, I'm incredibly sidetracked in the sense of, okay, God, this is what I thought you would protect me from.
Yeah.
But you didn't. And then the scriptural passages on learning obedience to the things that he suffered and don't be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you. And there's so much in scripture, as long as you're in the world, you will have trouble. Don't fear, I've overcome the world.
Yeah.
And you get a different view of God on the inside helping us navigate things like this, as opposed to the God on the outside that should keep all this from happening, or when it does happen, he really needs to punish the people who did me wrong.
Yes.
And the expectation that he would do that, because David prays for that a lot in the Psalms.
Yep.
Go ahead, nail their hide to a wall. And yet it rarely happens that way. That's not what we've been encouraged to seek. And to find that there's a God big enough inside of me and engaging me in a way that can take the worst that life can throw at you and still bring you further on into the knowing of him and in the loving of others. To me, that's one of the great things I look back in my life saying, I can't believe you did that. When those things were happening, I never thought that would be the fruit of those things. I never did. I just said, this is horrible. My whole life's been derailed. I've got to rebuild something from scratch. I've got to. And when that switched to, okay, you're present with me. This does not take you by surprise. You've endured this kind of stuff yourself. And yet you went on to be what God wanted you to be, Jesus. And so now I look back at these things in my life going, wow, I am not grateful they happened. I'm grateful that God was with me in them and that all of them have been turned to something. Maybe that was Freudian. into something that's beautiful that I could say, without those things, I wouldn't be the person I am today. And I really like the person I've become through the most difficult things in my life. And I like how it puts me in a place to be there for other people when they encounter those things and they're thrown off their game and they feel kind of lost. I love that I've been through that and can sit with them and not tell them what to do and not try to fix it, but I can just be with them as an understanding heart. I get it. I get why you're struggling.
Yeah. And that's, I think even there was a piece that in the article that really stood out to me when we were talking about how does God see sin and does it look like trauma? And we talked a little bit about that. And in this article, one of the things that stood out to me, it said, could the PTSD symptoms of moral injury be a kind of groaning too deep for words, a way for our body to communicate a depth of brokenness that we feel that cannot be articulated? What if our way of our bodies carrying grief is aligned with God's heart for creation rather than a source of shame? I was like, yeah, especially when we're experiencing or people are experiencing those symptoms of the injury, of the trauma, of that experience. Is it our bodies, is our hearts groaning for the justice of God to be made complete in this world, his justice to be made complete in my life, his justice to be made complete in the world around us? And that is this your spirit groaning in such a way, your body groaning in such a way that it's too deep for words, but it's still longing, crying out for the kingdom to be made complete in the world?
And I do. I've prayed a lot of those kinds of prayers at the deepest extremity of the things we've talked about here, where it's just, I don't even know how to pray other than just the groaning of my heart. And one of the things that says in the Old Testament were the cries of the people you have abused have risen to my heart, and now I'm acting. And I think those are deep, deep prayers that go to God in ways that move him.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.